Hi, I'm Taylor Sparrow.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is...
Neat!
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
Oh boy.
Yeah, oh boy, oh boy. We're answering your questions today.
That's right. This is it's going to be a two-part episode because we have a lot of questions from you and we've got some that we haven't gotten around to answering yet. So if you don't hear your question answered in this episode, it'll probably be in next week's group
or it'll be next time.
It'll be a whole episode. There are a couple that we reserve to be full episodes. So yes. we're getting through them.
We're getting through them, but we also understand that you'll probably keep sending them and we love that.
That's so, fine too.
Yeah, it'll be an ongoing thing. This won't be the last go round.
Yeah. Well, before we get into it, how was your week?
It was good. Lots of home improvement jobs right now.
That's a good feeling.
Yeah, it's great. My whole Sunday just disappeared because I painted the back office. Me and my roommate painted our office / studio, which is very, very exciting.
I love that for you.
We did it from start to finish. I feel like I am really strong. The home improvement force is strong with me because I'm building. Now, when I say building furniture, I mean assembling furniture.
like IKEA kind of stuff.
Yes. It's not from IKEA, but a box arrived. It was meant to be a bathroom safe space saver cabinet. And very similar to IKEA in the vein of like that it was the instructions were a booklet with a lot of pictures and no words and nothing zoomed in. So you had to kind of squint to see what part they were talking about, you know, but I did it. I assembled it. It's assembled. I also found lots of people. Okay. So lots of people are moving out of New York, right?
Yeah.
They're just leaving their shit on the side of the road. Some of that shit is really good shit. Mm-hmm. So I found a kind of dresser cabinet thing. The front was painted. Like, the drawers are all painted really cute. And it was a little bit beat up. But you know what? I took that shit home and I sanded it down and I stained it and I put polyurethane on it. And it looks great now. So I feel very, very accomplished. I've got an electric sander.
Wow.
I'm serious.
That sounds great.
Yeah. It's very empowering. I feel very powerful.
to make the most of what we're dealing with right now, I think using your kind of extra time and your kind of, you can't do much else, like having a project like building out an apartment and like making your space nice, that's a good thing to focus on.
Yeah.
That's like a nice healthy thing to be doing right now.
It's going to take a long time, but it's going to pay off.
That's
so
awesome.
Yeah. How was your week?
Well, I didn't assemble any furniture, so...
Well, your furniture is already assembled.
I have assembled my furniture.
You did a lot of stuff. You told me you drew and
I
you...
I drew. I made a little fried rice that looked like a pineapple.
Oh, that was so cute.
Yeah. I donated plasma.
Good job.
Yeah. I did that to help somebody.
You're an antibody.
Antibody. Yeah.
You got a cool armband.
I did. I got a cool, they give you like the sports wrap, the, you know, whatever when you're done.
Yeah.
And the guy that wrapped me up, he was very nice. He pulled a couple collars out of the drawer and then he kind of held them up to what I was wearing and then picked the purple one. I was like, this one. I'm like, I was hoping you'd pick that.
Yes.
But, yeah. So I don't know. I mean, if you're somebody that has had the COVID and recovered, plasma improves the likelihood of recovering like 35%.
That's awesome.
So, you know, it's obviously, you know, you got, if you're healthy, like you got to be healthy to donate plasma. You got to make sure you're in good condition first, but if you can, you know,
yeah.
They're definitely taking as much as they can get right now.
That's awesome. So, yeah, if you've got antibodies, be an antibody and donate plasma.
And they give you cookies.
Oh, my God.
I didn't do it for the cookies, but...
I would do it for the cookies.
My reasons were cookie adjacent. I like that they specifically, they give out Lorna Doones and Oreos at my donation place, both of which are vegan.
Oh, that's great. They're thinking about you.
Yeah, I don't think they're thinking about me, but maybe they're just covering their bases.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Sure, sure.
I'm excited for this episode because we have so many questions, really fun questions to answer. They're kind of all over the place. So I think we just dive right in.
Yeah, it was really fun to see how many folks asked really similar questions. Mm-hmm. So I got to group these together in some fun groups for you. You ready?
All right.
This is something that a lot of folks have been asking about. And that is, I kind of put this together in home bar essentials questions.
All right.
So Sally, Rogue Goat, and Mustachley, that's a great handle, name, by the way, all asked about home bar essentials. Sally's question, what are the basics, alcohol-wise, that you think every home bar should have?
So for the alcohol, for the spirits, I think you'd start with your base spirits, like a London Dry Gin, a Blanco Tequila, a white rum and a dark rum, because, you know, they play pretty different roles in cocktails. A whiskey, if you want to, like, have, like, a bourbon, a rye, and a scotch, that's great. But if you're going to have one, I think a bourbon will suffice. And then, of course, a vodka.
Nice.
So that kind of covers your standard base spirits. Beyond that, I think you might want a few classic modifiers. A dry vermouth and a sweet vermouth, pretty standard. Keep them in the fridge once you open them. I think Campari pops up in enough classics that it's a good bottle to have as like a standard modifier.
That's fair.
Yeah. And I think some kind of triple sec, you know, like, doesn't have to be Grand Marnier. You can get something kind of mid-shelf, lower shelf when you're first starting out. And then, of course, you probably want to have some bitters in your house. Mm-hmm. The holy trinity of bitters, the only bitters you need for classic cocktails are Angostura, Orange, and Peychaud's, but I think you can get by on just Ango to start. In modifiers, you could definitely build up that category as you go, because there are a lot of fun modifiers, but really you're going to get pretty far with just learning a basic simple syrup recipe, or how to make a honey syrup or an agave.
Yeah.
That's as far as sweeteners. You can branch into other cool liqueurs, but for starters, I would just get some triple sec.
Nice. Well, that's a good place to start. Now that we've got the spirits, Rogue Goat asks, what tools would you consider essential to a home bar?
I think we exhibited this in a video we did at the beach year before last, where we did not have many tools. We had no tools to work with.
We had to improvise a little bit.
I think that everything can be done with the omission of like a wine key, because it's really hard to open something that you need a wine key for without a wine key. But outside of that, I think you can always work with what you've got on hand. But if you want to like have a nice home bar, I think essentials are, like I said, a wine key, a bottle opener of some kind, standard. A jigger, definitely. Something that's marked off too, you have to check. Some of them don't have the demarcations. You definitely want one that has down to a fourth of an ounce and up to 2 ounces. Now, whether you get that on one single bell jigger or like a set of two Japanese style jiggers, that's up to you. It's a stylistic choice. But
okay.
I like the bell jigger because you get everything in one. The small size goes down to 1/4. The big side goes up to 2 ounces. So it's all just one piece. That's all you have to worry about. A muddler is pretty easy to come by. You don't need to spend money on that. And that's a pretty essential bar tool. If you don't have one, you can use a wooden spoon. If you don't have one, it's fine. But
you can use the handle of a wooden spoon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, speaking of spoons, a long bar spoon is a great at-home bar tool. A shaker of some kind. And we talked a bit more about shakers on the episode where we went in depth on shakers. But there are shakers out there that cost $100. You don't need that. I think I love the shakers at the restaurant supply stores. Just the simple tin, you know, small top, the bigger bottom that fit together. Mm-hmm. They're sturdy. They'll get the job done. They get cold enough. And if you bust it up, they're cheap enough that you can replace them. A mixing glass of some kind, but honestly, you can use a pint glass.
Yeah.
That's what I've used behind the bar in more bars than not. Another money trap, because you'll see like the beautiful like cut glass Urais. There are some
really cute ones.
They're beautiful. They don't do anything different than a pint glass. They're not doing anything different. Someone will surely come in with a theory. Well, actually, it aerates the ice better. Maybe.
Maybe.
But a pint glass is fine for a mixing glass. If you want to treat yourself to one of those cut glass, no problem there. Strainers, of course, are essential cocktail equipment. There are really three kinds you find behind the bar. There's the fine strainer, which is like a tea strainer.
Oh, yeah.
The Hawthorne strainer, which is the one that has like little whirly kind of spring on it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's the julep strainer, which is like the little metal disc with the big holes in it.
Oh, yes.
Of those, do you need all of them? I would say at least a Hawthorne and a fine strainer. The Hawthorne's going to do pretty much everything the julep strainer does. We just usually use the julep strainer on stirred drinks and the Hawthorne on shaken. But, they're also things where you can find them online for like $30, $40. You can also find them at restaurant supply stores and on the internet for like $6 or $7.
Sure.
So I think I would rather get us one of each at a lower price point than drop a bunch of money on one.
And if you had to choose between those, the one that's the fine strainer can do a lot, and it can also, you can use it for tea. You can.
Yeah, the fine strainer will do literally everything
that, I've had that to we're make do about. With it.
Yeah.
You can make do with a lot of these things, but it's just about your convenience really, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. But you're absolutely right though that a fine strainer is going to do, I mean, there I can think of like a case of like, well, I wouldn't want to fine strain an egg white cocktail.
Okay.
You would strain it through a Hawthorne and a fine strainer. So, it's kind of a double filtration. Anyway, it's a good point that of all of them, a fine strainer will get the job done most effectively. Mm-hmm. Hawthorne's kind of the most standard. Julep is really just if you're being stylish.
Fancy. Mm-hmm.
And of course, I thoroughly recommend a hand squeezer for fresh juice. Mm-hmm. Juicing machines are expensive and bottled juice is going to downgrade your cocktail significantly.
And it's hard to do it with your hands sometimes.
Yeah, you're just going to waste juice if you're trying to squeeze out everything by hand. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the hand squeezers, the ones I use are the ones you find in the grocery store.
Yeah.
They're like, I think, like $5.99 or something. They're
really easy to find.
They're cheap. They have like all the ones that come in like different sizes, and it'll lead you to believe you need like the lime one, the lemon one, and the orange one. You can get like one, and you can get like the biggest one and squeeze everything in it, or get like
a medium or small and then you can cut them, right?
Yeah, you can cut. I have like a good medium sized one, and if I have a particularly big piece of fruit, I'll just cut it into fourths instead of halves.
There you go. You don't need all that.
And then the other thing that I think it's overlooked, but I think some decent ice cube trays are good for home bartending. Trays that will give you 2x2 cubes and 1x1 cubes. 1x1 are great for shaking. 2x2 are great for neat over ice, stirred drinks. And that's definitely, definitely an overlooked ingredient that I think is necessary in good cocktails.
If you want to hear more about the importance of ice, good ice in your cocktails, you can listen to our episode, Ice, Ice, Shaky, all about shakers and ice.
Yes, yes. A lot of good recommendations in there.
Yes. And then Mustache, right? Mm-hmm. Mustachely?
It's got to be Mustachely.
Mustachely, yeah. It says, I'd personally like a Bartending 101 episode where y'all lay down some simple rules that help your at-home cocktails come out better. A list of hardware essentials, such as which shakers are best for if you really need a muddler, to help stock your at-home bar would be super helpful.
Some of this would make better video content that I think I can walk you through. Like, we've covered tools, we've covered some boozes. As far as simple rules to help your at-home cocktails come out better, more than anything, the number one focus should be freshness of ingredients. I've said it before, but low alcohol, liqueurs, syrups, vermouths, they need to be kept refrigerated. And I think any longer than a month, they're not really going to be as fresh or aromatic. Mm-hmm. So I think freshness, also with juices, always fresh juice. Just don't, if you're at home, you've got the time for it. Bottled lemon, bottled lime juice, don't use it. Even orange juice, like if you have the time to juice it. So really freshness with syrups, anything you can make by hand. Because I've seen like, the in-store grenadine and even simple syrup. It boggles my mind that they sell bottled simple syrup in the grocery store. Because it is simple. It is one part water, one part white sugar. And you're paying so much.
It's in the name. It's so simple.
Yeah. So really, like, just, like, making things fresh and making sure that your ingredients stay fresh, I think is really important. And start with the basics, but also don't be intimidated to experiment with something you really like. If you find a structure, a cocktail that you really like, feel free. You're at your home. You're in your safe space. Like, branch out. Like, try throwing another ingredient you love. Or like, but I do think as far as like sort of a bartending 101 video would be really good to go along with these questions. So we've talked about it before, but I would love sooner than later, we'll give you all a little like tour of my home bar and a bit more instructive visuals on home bartending.
That'll be really fun. So our next group of questions are all about garnishes. So let's kick it off with Holly Hotcraft asks, I'm curious about olives. Do they only show up in martinis, or are there other briny concoctions they feature in? Ooh, I love briny concoctions. That sounds delish.
I love briny concoctions. Just some brief history about olives in drinks in general. The martini is the first place we really see the olive as kind of an iconic ingredient. But the olives don't start showing up in martinis until more like the 1880s. So it's a little after that fabled birth of the martini that we talked about back in our martini episode. You know, it was California, or San Francisco was one of the gold miners, struck gold. Yeah. They didn't have champagne, so for some reason the bartender made him a Martinez, which, you know, has eventually evolved into the martini. But that drink that was supposedly made back then was probably made with a lemon twist, not an olive.
Oh, okay.
So California does still claim some ownership as being the birthplace of the olive martini in relation to that story. Mm. But there is maybe a more legitimate belief. There's a claim by a doctor from the Syrian Red Crescent, Dr. Amar Martini, who says that his grandfather went to Paris and managed a bar and a cafe to make a living after leaving Syria, and he brought his love of fresh Syrian olives with him and revolutionized his martini by swapping it as a garnish. So, you know, conflicting stories as to when the olive started getting into the martini.
Very interesting that this doctor's name is actually Martini.
That's very interesting.
That is very, I'm very curious about that.
And his story kind of is at the same time that the martini is supposedly, like a little after the martini supposedly happened in California. So I don't know if it's like, oh, that's my name, I should be good at that drink, but I'm going to add my own spin to it. Who knows? But regardless, olives in the martini happened sometime in the 19th century. Now, their real significant boost as the garnish of choice was actually under JFK's presidency, because JFK was a big fan of the dirty martini, and it kind of became very popular to drink a dirty martini.
He was a dirty guy.
Whoa.
I don't know. Should I not say that about JFK?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. But he liked his olives.
Hey.
So that. I was kind of poking around. There are a lot of like modern offerings that use olives as a garnish, but they're riffs on martinis. I made a martini with slightly different ingredients and I threw an olive in. And that's totally fine. But one category of drinks that utilizes olives, and it's far more like in the history of using the olive, which I really like, is actually the spritz.
Oh, so really?
We've talked about spritzes before, but there actually are a lot of traditional spritz recipes that will have like olive juice or an olive garnish, olive and an orange as a garnish. Like a classic, like Venetian spritz can sometimes be served as an olive. So then that's more of a historical thing. You know, it's not like new bartenders making new spins on martinis. Olives have been popping up in spritzes in Italy for a while now.
Okay. Interesting.
And I think it actually, it introduces something really different to a spritz, but something I really like. And I mean, if you think of some different ways of making a spritz, like a lot of spritzes will involve sherry. Sherry can have a lot of salinity to it. Salinity doesn't not belong in a spritz.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, that kind of idea of like a drier, salty wine with like some sherry and an olive garnish with soda makes a lot of sense.
Hey, I'm into it. I love salty, briny. I literally started my day with a shot of pickle juice this morning. Nice. So.
Well, and if you're a fan as well of briny concoctions, I think look into, there are a ton of recipes out there. I've talked about it before, but the book called Spritz that has some recipes in it too. But look into some of those like classic Italian spritzes that swap in olives and olive juice. It's a really cool category of drinks that I think you'd be down with.
Okay, I'm going to check that out. Okay, so we have two questions everybody wants to know. So first, let's go with Amelia's question. Hi, I have a bit of an obtuse one to what you usually talk about, but garnishes. I know they look pretty, but is that it? Does some of them add a final bit of flavor? Are there some more traditional ones than others? What's with the little paper umbrellas? And where did they come from? And thanks for making such a fun podcast. And Sarah, actually, this question adds on to that. Again, hi, folks. So the Tiki live stream made me wonder if there is any particular history to cocktail umbrellas. Do they come from Tiki culture or did they start somewhere else?
All right, so to get to the first part of this question about garnishes in general, while yes, sometimes garnishes are just pretty, traditionally and historically, that's not what they're there for. Even now, as a general rule in bartending, if you're going to put a garnish in a drink, it should do something. It should add to the flavor. It should provide aromatics. In the oldest classic cocktails, the garnish is treated as an ingredient. It's not just performing for looks. Mm-hmm. And it can be as simple as like that lime on the side of your vodka soda. It's not just adding some color to an otherwise, you know, vacant drink. It's giving you some nice citrusy aromatics, and it's also giving you the option to add some acid to your drink should you want to. To get into more like classic employments of garnishes, in a Manhattan, I would say that cocktail cherry is really necessary to add a little touch of sweetness to a cocktail that can play a little dry without it. That's why I would never use like a bad grocery store toxic cherry in a Manhattan. I think it's much better with a better cherry. It's a different drink. Same with an old fashioned. I would say if you don't have an orange twist to make an old fashioned, don't make an old fashioned. Because when drinks are that simple, that orange oil and that essence, both the aromatics and the way it plays on your tongue, opens up the drink, makes you taste it a lot differently. And you can kind of think of the physics of drinking when we talk about garnishes, because when you're taking a drink, you're bringing a glass close to your face. Smell is a huge impact mm-hmm. on how we taste things. So that garnish is offering the ability to provide really strong aromatics, sometimes just to enhance the experience. Like if you have like a big bunch of mint on top of a mojito. If you sniff a mojito that has not had mint put on top of it, it just kind of smells, it's a, maybe a little minty. You know, alcohol isn't necessarily the most pleasant smell. You don't smell like caramel and like roast and chocolate in whiskey. You taste it. You can kind of get some notes, but it's more of a taste. Mm-hmm. But you can play up what you're expecting to taste by layering on a smell that matches with what you're going to taste. Putting fresh herbs on top or fruit kind of give you a clue as to what you're then going to have in the drink and even kind of influence what you're expecting to taste. And also, sometimes garnishes are employed to cover up something that they don't want you to smell. Case in point, the egg white cocktail. Egg whites don't smell good. They're very caustic. They don't. Yeah. So that pretty little design on like a proper whiskey sour of Angostura bitters, yes, that's there to look nice and give you a little heart in your cocktail, but it's also there to make you smell Angostura bitters, which are delicious and lovely to smell, instead of egg whites.
Yeah, that is better. That's an improvement.
Yeah. So it's really, you know, when you look at most classics, the garnishes are playing a role in the drink. It's really, I think, only in the explosion of sort of craft cocktails that we start to see so many common non-functional garnishes. Mm-hmm. The only time period we really see it kind of in the same level is like in the 50s with tiki culture.
Okay.
Suddenly you have things that are just there to look kind of extravagant and decorative.
Right, because that in that particular niche of drink making, it was about aesthetic.
There was, yeah. And I mean, that carries through all and up into the 80s, you know. Okay, yeah. In the 60s too, like swizzle sticks and, you know, like fake flowers and little mermaids and
plastic swords.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Like all that stuff is really just taking the garnish farther away from an ingredient and more into just a dressing, which brings us to the umbrellas. Now, I say all this, I don't have anything against a non-functional garnish. Sometimes it's just nice.
Sometimes it's just cute.
Yeah, I've used plenty in my day.
You put little rubber duckies in them.
I've put rubber duckies in drinks. I've put the mermaids in drinks. I've done all sorts of non-functional garnishes. So sometimes it's just a nice photo, the moment. But specifically the umbrella, I don't have anything against. There is some history to the umbrella, though. And I love that, as we've learned in so many of these stories, people want to fight for who made the tiki umbrella as well.
Of course.
I should say that they were on the market, they're readily available, but who started using them first in association with tiki culture is up for grabs. According to cocktail historian Dale DeGroff, it was Don the Beachcomber who started the trend in the 1930s when he was kicking off his whole like tiki bar craze. And it was just sort of playing on the aesthetic of some of the stuff that he found in the South Pacific.
Okay.
For these little umbrellas. Now, Beach did sell cocktail umbrellas to Trader Vic, who we talked about in our episode, one of the other like main owners of a tiki bar empire, Trader Vic's. He used the paper umbrellas in his drinks until their production was briefly halted during World War II. Now, there's a conflicting story that comes to us by way of author Rick Carroll, who sort of like writes specifically around like Hawaiian culture. And he says it was a Hawaiian bartender by the name of Harry K. Yee, who worked at the Hilton Waikiki. He first used paper parasols in 1959.
Okay.
So it's a little after Dale DeGroff claims that Trader Vic was using them. And this was definitely the height of the tiki craze, so you would have thought they were kind of already out there at that point in time. But Yee also like echoes this by saying he started off with using sugar cane in his tiki drinks, and you know, people were just kind of laying them to the side anyway. They weren't engaging with them, which sugar cane you can use in a drink is like an element. You can chew on sugar cane.
Nice.
So he switched from the sticks to like orchids, which you'll still see in tiki drinks. So he have been the first one to use orchids in cocktails. And then from there, he decided the cocktail umbrella was the best choice. At that point, I mean, the bar already had them, so it's hard to say. He kind of could have had access to them.
All right. But maybe he was the one who was like, we're using these.
Yeah. Now, there is this other theory, which I think it's funny, that says, well, maybe they're both right, is that Beach actually met Yee while vacationing in Hawaii. And they exchanged ideas, recipes. There was some overlap in some of the stuff they were doing at the same time.
Okay.
And so one of them had the idea of using the umbrellas and the other one took it and capitalized on it. So it's possible that these two people just influenced each other and they both were using these little umbrellas at the same time.
Okay. But I'll buy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look at this. Like, just historical bartenders are willing to argue over the origins of anything.
Pretty much. In that spirit, let's really get into it with some spirits questions.
In that spirit.
Yes. So one of our dear listeners wrote us a beautiful long note. Amber wrote us a very nice letter, and I'm going to read part of it. Thank you so much for sending this in. So Amber says, I have never really liked gin, and in doing some digging, I see that most of it is processed with licorice root, which I'm allergic to. Makes my tongue swell. Nothing Benadryl can't fix, but still not fun. Yeah, doesn't sound fun. So maybe I have gotten a bit of tongue tingle, and that's why I don't like it. Do you know of any gins that don't use licorice root? Also, similar question for liqueurs and bitters. Seems like Jaeger and Fernet also have licorice, but I know some others may be using anise, which doesn't cause a reaction for me. Any good resources for checking potential allergens in booze? I'm so excited about experimenting, but I don't want to have to end my night with Benadryl and an early bedtime.
Well, here's the thing. I won't lie. Licorice is one of the top 10 botanicals that's you're going to find in most gins. Like, that's one of the traditional elements used in gin. And most of the big gin brands, I looked into it, definitely use it. Tanqueray, Bombay, Beefeater, Gordon's, they all have licorice root in there. But there are some great, easy-to-find gins that don't. Hendrick's doesn't.
Nice.
All right. Plymouth gin doesn't.
Oh.
Roku gin, which is, it's newer on the market, it's one of my favorites. It's Japanese gin. It uses a bunch of really cool Japanese botanicals, but specifically avoids licorice. And also The Botanist. I was surprised by that, because The Botanist has like 22 botanicals in it, but does not have licorice root. So, and those are really, those style-wise are all over the place. Like, Hendrick's is really like vegetal. It's rose and cucumber, so it's, you know, really nice and aromatic. Plymouth is very structured, very strong. Roku is really kind of, it's kind of fruity. It has some nice yuzu notes. And Botanist is very aromatic. So you've got a really fun selection of different types of gins that you could, that I, for the most part, are pretty easy to find. They're pretty widely distributed, and they're not going to set you back too far. Now, when dealing with an allergy, I'd always take a second to check the ingredients. And unfortunately, so many of the, when we get into the realm of liqueurs and amaros and bitters, we're dealing with secret recipes.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I wonder how they still get away with that with the FDA and all that, like not explicitly saying what their ingredients are.
You know, that's a good question, because I really did want to check at least, I wanted to try to find like at least an amaro that I could say, well, this one doesn't have it. You know, there were some that I found that they proudly list that they have anise, which could mean that they don't have licorice, but I would not feel 100% saying that. And a lot of the ones you noted that you had doubts about, you were absolutely right. Like Chinar, Aperol, Montenegro, Fernet, like they all have licorice root in them. Like I looked, Maletti is a Amaro that I'm a fan of that does use anise. It doesn't list licorice root, but like I said, I would rather be safe than sorry. But, well, I will say, I don't know where you live, but locally produced spirits, you know, I think here in New York, there are a couple companies that make their own Amaros that they're hard to get a hold of outside of the state, but they're way more open about what they put in them.
Yeah, that's not a gamble that you want to take.
Well, and it's really, you know, I think it's moving out of the, like, in the bitter realm and the Amaro realm, that's where you get all those secret recipes. I think you'll be fine with most, like, fruit liqueurs and like floral liqueurs, because they're pretty clear about what they're doing, you know, like a creme de peche is a peach liqueur, you know, things that kind of have that simple recipe, I think, or that simple formula, I think you can trust. But yeah, when you get into the brands, I checked Chartreuse has, they list licorice root. Of all the things they don't list, they do list, they have that.
Maybe they figured out that some people are allergic to it.
Maybe. I would say, I think this is something that we could do. It would be a really fun video to do at some point. We did the bitter episode last year. But if you listen to our Amaro episode, Amaros are really just a step past bitters. You make bitters first, and then you sweeten them and reduce the alcohol content. Then you end up with an Amaro. So I think making Amaros that specifically avoid licorice would be very easy.
Hey,
so maybe, you know, I unfortunately can't give you any resources to figure out what does or does not have licorice root outside of going brand by brand and hoping they tell you everything. But maybe we can provide you with a recipe so you could at least at home make some Amaro and get the experience of drinking it and, you know that you didn't have licorice root in there.
Yeah, that seems fun. That's an option. Next question comes from Carly. What is the history of non-alcoholic faux liquors? When did they appear versus just a regular liquorless mocktail? How do they imitate the things they're supposed to replace? Sorry if you covered this in another episode and I'm just being a goldfish. Don't worry, you're not a goldfish. We talked a little bit about some of the spirits that are on the market when we did our Dry January episode.
We did. As far as a history of non-alcoholic, like, drinks, like, not spirits, but are fermented. I mean, those go back a little farther in history. Like, we talked a bit about non-alcoholic beer.
Okay,
that goes
yes,
a bit farther
yes.
in time. There's, like, amazake, which is, like, non-alcoholic sake. That's pretty old and pretty traditional. And, like, young, you know, kids and adults enjoy it alike. But specifically, this non-alcoholic faux liquor that is meant to imitate liquor, that's super new. That is, I would say, the past decade, but yeah, maybe like the past 5 years.
What is that brand called? Sedums or
Seedlip? Seedlip is one brand, Seedlip. But there's a lot now. I mean, there's a ton of brands that are trying to. They're kind of coming up alongside the Sober Curious movement. You know, definitely the side of sort of health conscious millennial push that we're experiencing in the industry. Which isn't to say people are drinking less. I saw a study recently that people are drinking like twice as much.
Well, now, definitely.
Well, quarantine, but also just in general. But still, it's definitely a growing category. And I will say, my personal experience, as far as do they taste like liquor, the ones that I've tried, and to be fair, I've only tried a few. I've tried Seedlip, I've tried Kin, like, they are taking elements of liquor and they're adding them to a non-alcoholic infusion. So it's kind of like in our mocktail episode where we made just a botanical infusion into a tea to mimic gin.
Okay.
It worked okay, but yeah. If you try it on its own, you are not going to think, oh, this is gin.
No.
Like, you're not going to think that. It kind of tastes to me like you're getting all the kind of nice flavor notes, but alcohol has a specific property when it interacts with your taste buds. It kind of opens things up.
Mm-hmm.
It acts on your tongue differently. My problem is the ones that I tried. I felt like I was paying liquor prices for infused water.
Okay. You need something with a little bit more of a bite. More of a...
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to mimic that with something that's not alcohol. Now, I will say, that being said, in researching this question, I did realize that there's an explosion in this category of things that aren't necessarily just specifically trying to, mimicking vodka or gin or whiskey. That's hard because so many of those flavor notes are specifically dependent on the esters derived from fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
You can't, there's not a one-to-one for those. However, there are a lot of products that aren't trying to, they aren't bothered by being like traditional spirits. They're mimicking things that are a bit more dependent on modifiers. So by that, I mean, like, there's a Proteo, which is a product created by one of the bar veterans at Momofuku, John DeBerry. And it's basically like a botanical aperitif that's meant to fill the vermouth void. Non-alcoholic wine is pretty easy. Like, you can ferment grape juice and take out the alcohol and still get something that's sort of musty. And, I mean, like, vinegar is, you know, along that way. And then you could heavily infuse it with your floral elements or your botanicals of choice, and you would easily get something that mimics a vermouth. That sounds promising.
Yeah.
There's Sanbitter, which is a Campari alternative, which similarly, Campari is a ton of like heavily, heavily infused botanicals and sugar. And you don't taste alcohol when you taste Campari. You taste everything else. So the idea that you could mimic all of that successfully, absolutely. There's another brand that thought sounded exciting, Three Spirits, which is supposed to be a great Amaro sub.
Mm.
And I mean, similarly, like your flavor profile in most Amaros, it's not built on liquor. You're using a grain neutral spirit that's just there to extract. So if you can properly extract a bunch of herbal like liqueurs and, you know, hit them with like a proper level of sugar, you could mimic an Amaro, I think, without liquor.
Nice.
Yeah.
So that's cool.
I think that the category is going to keep growing. I wouldn't rule them out anytime soon. I just would say that, you know, the ones that try to go head-to-head with gin, I think that's just...
That's hard.
You're going to... And I mean, it's totally fine, like, to not taste like what it's trying to imitate. They're making a new category. But for me personally, like, I'm more excited by the ones that I think you could sub in very easily and not lose anything in, like, classic cocktails.
Hey. Okay. Cool. Good to know.
Yeah.
That's exciting news. Well, our next question is from Michael. Michael asks, I had a question though.
Okay.
I had a question though about the whiskey stuff. What makes a whiskey peaty? Also, like, what is that peaty flavor? Is it legit peat moss? I love whatever the hell it is, but I got no idea, lol.
Oh, this is a great question.
I really enjoyed channeling you in, because I feel like, I had a question, though. Okay, yes, that's wonderful.
I'll tell you what the hell is going on.
What the hell is going on?
Well, the answer is pretty easy. It's peat. That's peat that you're tasting. Now, what is peat? Peat, for a long time, it's the most readily available fossil fuel in Scotland. Peat being produced by the slow decomposition of plant material such as moss, grass, and tree roots in accumulations in bog water.
What?
Yeah. So, I mean, it sits for so long that it's basically a fossil fuel, like the layers of...
Oh, shit. Oh. That's right. Oh, mm-hmm. My God. My favorite thing when I had the opportunity to go to Ireland, and we went to the Ireland Museum of Archaeology, and they had things that had been preserved in the bog.
Mm.
And I mean, like, things that human, like, ancient human beings were like, we know that the bog does something, so we're gonna store our shit in it and we'll come back later for this. Like, bog butter? Weird.
Like, whole people.
They pulled whole people. No, they did. They people were very well preserved in bogs.
So, yeah. So, you know, bogs... Bog's just the ancient refrigerator.
They are.
Ancient, dirty refrigerator. I don't know about that, but they at least make peat, which is useful. Peat.
Okay, good. So, they're magic. Magical bogs.
Magical bogs produce peat. Pete was introduced to the whiskey process as a way to dry the malted barley that's necessary for whiskey.
Okay.
So what I mean, malted barley, basically, barley corns are steeped in water. It kind of makes them think it's spring, so they start to germinate. And then they halt the process of germination by then putting it in a kiln that's heated with peat. Why was it heated with peat? Because that's what they had.
Okay.
Now,
we got some peat.
That's where they got peat.
So let's put it in there.
And it produces this incredibly aromatic smoke that flavors the malt heavily. These flavor compounds are called phenols. Now, as other sources of fuel became available, some distilleries switched away from the peat. That's why you get scotch categorized as unpeated or peated scotch. Mm-hmm. But those that have kept it can use it just as a stylistic choice now, because you get that smokiness. Then there's actually a scale of peat measurement, the PPM or phenol parts per million, that's used to measure the concentration of peatiness in peated whiskey.
Ooh.
And I say whiskey, not scotch, because there's whiskey made outside of Scotland that uses peat in the heating process, specifically to get that nice roasty peaty quality. I love peaty scotch. I love peaty whiskey. I'm always a little bit sad when something's specifically unpeated.
I mean, I never was like so crazy about peat, but now that I know it comes from bog magic, I think I'm going to get into it.
I think the worst way I've ever heard peat flavor explained is that it tastes like a Band-Aid. But then if you think Band-Aid when you're drinking peated scotch, there's a moment of like, yeah. Like a smoky Band-Aid.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
I never thought about that.
So
now that I know that it is bog magic, I think I'm a little bit happier for the whiskey peat mowage.
Speaking of mowage,
we've got some wedding questions. Our first wedding question. Ooh, there's a prologue to this wedding question.
Yes.
So this is from Anna or Anna. I don't know if maybe you're from Arendelle. Who knows? Hmm. Prologue.
Okay.
I'm at the stage of my life where lots of friends are getting married.
Now that you've compared it to the character from Frozen, I just want this part to be sung. I'm at the stage of my life where lots of my friends are getting married.
Yes! Most of these have basic bar setups, standard well liquors, and simple mixers.
I like Frozen 3 already.
It's good. Question. When attending events with simple hosted bars, I usually default to a Jack and Coke or a Rum and Coke. This almost always leaves me with a caffeine high at the end of the night. Ah, oh, what's a princess to do? Which I feel on top of any alcohol affects the next day. What are some options for drinks at a basic event bar that taste good but don't involve a ton of caffeinated mixers? I don't want to be a pain for the poor catering company bartenders.
All right. It's a good question. The wedding bar. I've worked a few, and I will say it's always a mixed bag of what you're going to be working with. You know, sometimes you show up and it's like, here's a bunch of base spirits with no mixers. And I'm like, okay, do you want vodka and ice or rum and ice? That's what I got. If there's ice. I think, you know, more often than not, there are some things you can kind of assume are going to be there. You're going to have base spirits. You're going to have some juices. You're probably going to have some vermouths.
Okay.
You probably will have some triple sec.
Right.
So
you'll at least have soda, right? Seltzer?
Well, I mean, that's what the basic answer, I think, is if you want to avoid caffeine, but you like a Jack and Coke or a rum and Coke, you could probably do like a, I mean, honestly, like a whiskey soda is pretty nice.
Yeah.
And you're going to avoid the caffeine that way.
Squeeze a little lime in there.
Yeah. A gin and tonic is classic. It's delicious. Tequila and tonic. A tectonic, if you will.
A tectonic. Ooh.
That was Hank Green. We did that panel at a PodCon where he said that was his drink of choice.
So. Oh, a tectonic.
Yes. I'm crediting Hank Green on that one.
Hey.
You know, yeah, vodka soda. If you've got some juice there, you can easily ask for like a base spirit soda and some juice is going to taste pretty nice, keep you hydrated.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask about, because I feel like part of the hangover for me is definitely like the sugar. So if you're, you know, like I don't think you're necessarily going to be saved from the hangover by getting a tequila OJ, you know.
No, I mean, it depends.
And also acid reflux.
Yeah. Because I do think, like, you know, tequila grapefruit is a nice... Tequila grapefruit and soda is a nice, like, easily built. Yeah. Whiskey grapefruit, if you're a whiskey drinker, sounds like you might be a fan of dark spirits. Okay. If they've got ginger ale or ginger beer, neither of those are caffeinated. So hey, a rum and ginger ale is going to be similar to what you're used to, but mm-hmm. you're not going to have that caffeine. Now, if you scope out the bar and you see some visible triple sec or vermouth, you could open up some simple classics, you know?
Hey, you can get a martini.
Yeah. Manhattan. Margarita, maybe a sidecar.
Hey.
You know, but I'd also say it's a wedding, so there's probably bubbles.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, a nice, like, a spritz is always good for a wedding because you're there for a long time. You don't want to be wasted at a wedding.
Mm-hmm.
From personal experience, you don't want to be that wedding guest. And a spritz is nice because it's going to add some, you know, water, some sparkling water that you're going to, you know, stay hydrated, not get too drunk too fast, and they probably have the elements there to make that pretty now, easily.
Can you give, I think, me, a wedding guest, when you say spritz, I think of a lot of different types of spritz. What specific kind of spritz are you?
Oh, I'm thinking like a white wine spritz. Oh,
okay.
Like wine and soda or,
yes,
you know, like
all
that.
Right, all right.
Now, I mean, like also, If there's champagne, you could, like, champagne with a little juice in it is such a nice, like, some, you know, bubbles and grapefruit juice or even bubbles and orange juice.
Maybe start with champagne and OJ. As the evening progresses, then switch over to a white wine spritz. You know, you got a little bit of that water in there. You're going to need it.
You're dancing. You're around people. If you're me, your anxiety is being triggered like crazy.
Social
so you want to drink. So it's good to have that water in there. Mm-hmm. But I also say more than anything, speaking as an experienced wedding bartender, ask your bartender. Anytime I roll up to an event like that where I'm just working with whatever I've got, I'm going to quickly make a list in my head of what I can and can't make.
Mm-hmm.
And so if a customer says like, oh, what do you have the ability to make? Or, you know, like if I just want something light and refreshing, what can you make me? I guarantee you that bartender's going to answer you with something that's easy for them to make,
mm-hmm.
but might reveal like something cool that they have planned. Maybe there's a punch. Maybe there's some custom cocktails.
Yeah.
Like, so I think it's always, you know, take if it's a super busy bar, I think, you know, order something, order a one-in-one, and that's cool. But if you have that second just to ask the bartender, like, oh, I don't know what you have back there, but, you know, if there's something that you could make me, that's great. Like, engage with your bartender because they've definitely looked over everything and they know what they can and can't make. They've already figured out some quick drinks they can make.
Yeah. One of the weddings that I worked, we made a really nice mint lemonade. We had it prepped in a cooler we had made that day. And that was really easy to add that lemonade to, like, a nice rum. That, like the chances are, if they've done their due diligence and prepped for this wedding, they have something in mind. Usually, the wedding party has a signature cocktail or something like that, which it's not guaranteed that you're going to like that.
Yeah.
But got a lot of options there. To your point, like, ask your bartender what they're excited about giving you, because they're not going to tell you something that is going to be really difficult for them.
Yeah. Like, I've always just looked over and been like, okay, here's the short list of things I can make. And when someone says, what can you make me? I'm like, here are the five drinks that I can make you comfortably.
Yeah.
I will tell you, you know?
That's nice.
But yeah.
And it's super sweet that you're thinking about them.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, don't ever be afraid to engage with your bartender. They're anyone that like is that treats you not great for just asking a simple question like, oh, what is easy for you to make? I don't know what you have. Like, that's just not a good bartender. Don't take that personally.
Yeah, no, that's definitely they want you to ask
that
question for sure.
It's always easier to do that than the fun game of, I wanted this. Oh, I can't make that. I'm sorry. Then this. I can't make that either. Can I tell you what I can?
Oh, yes. Oh, man. Well, here's another question for you. Another wedding question. This next question comes from A. Minchu, and they asked, my sister is getting married this year, so cue me not very happily buying and wearing a bridesmaid's dress. Been there.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I would very happily buy her and her fiance some nice booze. What a wonderful sibling you are. Can you recommend a nice champagne that won't bankrupt me?
All right. So if you want to stick to champagne proper, as in, you know, sparkling wine made in the Champagne region of France, I don't know exactly what your budget is, but there are some good affordable bottles you can get in like the $30 to $50 price range. Paul Roger is the first one that comes to mind. That's one that I've specifically stocked at my bar because it is good, like medium bodied champagne that is, I think, like retails for maybe $35 a bottle. It's real champagne. It's the real deal. There's Veuve Clicquot, which is a pretty widely available brand that is classic champagne made in the Champagne region of France. And I think that's more like the $40 to $50 price range. They have a really nice rosé, sparkling rosé that I like a lot. Piper Heidsieck is another one that I've worked with that is similarly priced. It's a little bit more on the dry side, but true champagnes. So these are all true champagnes that'll be somewhere in the $30 to $50 price range, and definitely a far cry from your Dom Pérignon's.
Nice.
However, I don't know your budget, and maybe you're thinking, well, I want to get a couple bottles, you know, or I just, maybe your price range is not $50, and that's totally doable. I think that there are a lot of great sparkling wines that might not carry the champagne label, but they're either made in the exact same way as champagne, and the reason they're cheaper is because they weren't made
in champagne.
Yeah. Or they're made elsewhere in a slightly different way, but they're really good. So in that category, I mean, we have a ton of sparkling wine coming out of California that's really affordable. Depending on what's available to you, like big brands like Korbel and Candon, they're like made in the method champagne. They are sub $20 bottles. They're solid. I really, as something special, I really like the Sofia Coppola Sparkling Rosé from California.
Okay.
That's a little bit more expensive. I think it's like 28, maybe?
That's not too bad.
But as far as a gift, it's gorgeous. It's a sparkling rosé. It comes in a beautiful bottle. It comes like wrapped in like a beautiful pink cloth.
Ooh.
It's a really great present. There's also Roederer Estate. They are the American branch of the French producers of Cristal. So, oh. Roederer Estate opened in California. In France, their stuff is way more expensive, but they are making amazing sparkling wine out of California. And so, if you want something that tastes like Cristal, but has an eighth of the price tag, check them out. And then outside of that, if you want champagne-adjacent bubbles that are made in France, but they're not made in the Champagne region, I love Cremant. Cremant is amazing. It's a little bit more like boutique, I guess. It's not as widely known, but it's champagne slightly outside of Champagne region, France.
All right.
And then if you just, you know, want to go to different styles entirely, I love Cava.
Cava's great.
Yeah. It's Spain's answer to champagne. There's a ton of amazing, affordable, like $15 bottles of Cava out there that you can get. Also, one area of sparkling wine that's really exciting right now is South African sparkling wine.
Oh.
You want to always look for like the MCC, which means it's made in the method champagne on the bottle. But Colmont and Graham Beck are the two brands that come to mind. But there's a ton of really great, really affordable, properly made method champagne sparkling wine coming out of South Africa that will be something a little different. That you could gift the happy couple that would be, you know, introduce them to wine from a different place that maybe they haven't had before.
Nice. That this next group of questions are all about cocktails, and our first question comes from Joe. You know Joe.
Hey, Joe.
You know Joe. Joe asks, is a martini a drink or a build, since I've heard Cosmos referred to as a martini build? Would you illuminate us on that?
Yes, so it is a drink specifically. So many things get called a martini because the 80s put everything in a martini glass and called it a martini.
Mm-hmm.
But the martini is a specific drink with specific ingredients. Now, if it's gin or vodka, if it's equal parts dry vermouth or a quarter ounce of dry vermouth or just a dash of dry vermouth in the glass, that's all stylistic choices. But the constraints of a martini are just that. They are gin or vodka, dry vermouth, olive or lemon twist. Like, that's it. Now, I call it a build sometimes, and I think a lot of bartenders do, in the sense that we use that blueprint to make other cocktails that have a similar combination of base spirit and vermouth.
Okay.
So I think in the modern era, we might say, oh, this is a martini build. But when I say that to, like, if I were to say that to somebody. What I mean is, it's a combination of base spirit and vermouth.
Okay. Would a Cosmo be included in that?
Nope.
No.
Cosmo, if anything, I mean, it's vodka, triple sec. There is some cranberry juice in there, and then citrus. So in that sense, it's, if anything, it's closer to a daisy.
Yeah.
It's like a modified daisy build. Okay. Definitely not a martini. You can have martini, like, riffs, but a martini is a specific thing. Don't let anybody give you something blue and say otherwise.
All right. That's ammo for you when you go out in the world.
Yes.
Don't let them tell you it's a martini when you know that a martini is base spirit and vermouth.
Yep.
Okay. Sierra asks, after the episode on Aperol, I bought some, good for you, and started to experiment with you.
Yay!
That's awesome. I found that I really enjoyed mixing Aperol with lemonade. Ooh.
Sounds great.
And adding a touch of vodka and an orange wedge if I wanted to take it to the next level.
Love it.
To be really refreshing. What should I call this drink? And are there any good guidelines for naming drinks that you craft yourself / are adaptations of existing drinks?
That's a fun question. I mean, first and foremost, there are no rules for naming drinks, so name it after yourself. Sierra's a great name for a good drink. That sounds like a good drink.
Oh, that sounds great.
I would definitely drink an Aperol vodka lemonade with an orange wedge. Yeah, that sounds tasty.
That sounds like a Sierra.
It's a Sierra. Sierra Mist? Wait, that's...
No.
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 Okay.
It's
that's
not
a thing.
It's trademarked.
Yeah, all right. But as far as, like, my way of naming drinks, I will say, for me personally, it's almost harder for me to name a drink than to come up with a drink.
Yeah, that's a big hurdle for us, I'd say, when we're making the videos. And
because a name is for, like, once you put a name to it, like, that's forever. You know, you can fuss around with the ingredients, but a name is a name. But some of the things that, like, I do and I see other people do, it's like, if you're basing it off an existing drink, it's sometimes nice to give a nod to the drink it came from. So, like, a common example of this is, like, we've talked about the French 75. That's named after a piece of French artillery. So if you're going to do a play off of a French 75, you could name it after a different piece of artillery. Or you could keep the 75 but kind of call it something else. I've seen a lot of those. Like a something 75, you know? And you see that too with, like, an old fashioned. I'm thinking of, like, Please Don't Tell, a very iconic bar in New York City. It has the Benton's Old Fashioned, a very famous play on an old fashioned, and they call it the Benton's Old Fashioned. That's their version of an old fashioned. The Oaxaca Old Fashioned, which is made with mezcal. That's the inclusion of Oaxaca is saying, oh, it's got mezcal, it's got tequila in it, it's from a different place, but it's still an old fashioned build. So you can always, I like when a drink gives me some clue as to where it came from, either with the build or, you know, with the location, like where your ingredients come from, where your base spirit calls home. Like, Is there something culturally you can pull from? I think it's a, you know, some people just name things after songs they like or or movies they like, and that's fine. But I specifically, and this is just preference, like drinks that have some relationship between the name and the drink. Even if it's just, I'm thinking of the Rose Nyland was a drink that I did. I did like a, it was like a pink Negroni, and we called it the Rose Nyland after one of the Golden Girls. Because it was just, you know, it was strong, it was a little bitter, it was kind of a sassy floral cocktail, and it just made sense. So even if it's just you're thinking of the ingredients in the cocktail and kind of making an homage to a person, I definitely like a drink that gives you an enticing hint of what might be in the glass, but doesn't give it all away.
I love it.
Like, I don't like putting ingredients in cocktails and cocktail names.
Right.
Like saying, like, this is a sweet pea green pepper sour. It's like, okay. It is.
Yeah,
but
what, sure. Oh, that's cute. All right. So our last question in this category is a very specific one. Very specific recommendation, also from A. Minshew. Good on you for getting two questions in the same episode.
Hello again.
Hello. They asked, my dad wants to get into cocktails, but can't stand anything that's even slightly sweet. He also only likes bourbon and vodka as far as base spirits go, so that limits my choices on what I can introduce him to. Do you have any drinks I could try making for him, preferably lower ABV drinks?
All right, we can work with that. Now, this is interesting because there's a plentiful amount of low ABV cocktails. And there are a lot of drinks that aren't sweet. But typically the things we add to drinks to stretch them out and make them lower ABV and make them also sweeter. So this is a fun kind of catch-22 we've got here. But I think we can talk through it. So obviously, if your dad wants you to do cocktails, classics are where you start. And in the classic, there's a lot you can show him. I'm thinking, first off, of like a vodka martini, but in the traditional sense of an equal parts vodka martini.
Oh!
Martinis started off being 50-50 mixtures of vermouth to spirit.
And now, that's lovely.
It's lovely. It's going to be lower ABV. And I know it sounds like it might be sweeter because you've got an equal proportion of vermouth to vodka in there. It's not going to taste like fruit juice by any means. Yes, no. Yes, vermouth adds sweetness, but it's still going to be balanced. So I think like a equal parts vodka martini, or like an equal parts vodka martini with, you know, like a lemon twist, maybe some bitters, some orange bitters added to it. That's a good place to start. That's going to be a little lower ABV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you could even do the same with like a perfect Manhattan, which...
Oh.
That's equal parts dry and sweet vermouth. So you're reducing a little bit of the sweetness from the sweet vermouth. And you could still mess with the proportions of vermouth to whiskey, in this case rye, mm-hmm. and get a drier drink, but also get something that's a little lower alcohol. Kind of spinning off from that, you have like the Old Pal and the Boulevardier, two sort of whiskey Negronis. They're all alcohol, so that's not going to be necessarily less alcohol.
Yee.
But
yeah. He might like it.
I think yeah, like, you know, in that case, like, he might like it because they're just bitter drinks that you know are based in whiskey. Now I will say, I've talked about spritzes a couple times in this episode, but I think like a nice like an amaro spritz, because like a bitter amaro spritz would be something that you could work with. It wouldn't have a base spirit in there, but it would be nice and bitter. And brisk.
I was gonna say an Americano is like,
oh yeah, absolutely.
Like, I mean, that doesn't have any of those base spirits in it, but it is a not sweet cocktail, and it is low ABV. And I feel like that's something that you would, you know, if you're going to hand it to him and he doesn't know what it is, he might not know that there isn't a base spirit that he likes in there. Even going deeper into that, the original ideation of that, which is a Milano Torino.
Right.
Just Campari and vermouth. That's going to be super bitter. Not real sweet at all, and not give you a break with the soda. But if you want it to be even lower ABV, then... You know, an Americano is just giving you a little bit of soda on there, and that's going to be real refreshing.
I will also say, one of my personal favorite low ABV cocktails, and also just a great ingredient that you could maybe introduce your dad to, is medium dry to dry sherry cocktails.
Ooh.
Because I don't know, for me, I feel like they have a lot of the same elements that like a whiskey drinker would enjoy. I love a Bamboo. It's equal parts Amontillado sherry and dry vermouth. Got some orange bitters and a lemon twist, and it is just, it's bracing, it's nutty. There's nothing sweet about it, but it's very low alcohol, and it's a great, like, sophisticated cocktail for somebody that I think is very adverse to sweet and mm-hmm. is adverse to high alcohol. So, you know.
Nice.
And you probably, frankly, you could throw a little bit of bourbon in there and make a really, it would be a good little... extra nudge in that drink that still would keep the alcohol pretty low and would keep the integrity of the drink. So
nice. You know. I think those are all good options for that.
I just feel like I'm the secret Bamboo lobby in the world. Like, I just want everybody to drink cocktails all the time.
During our Hemingway investigation, you called sherry cocktails boat drinks.
No, I don't think I called sherry cocktails boat drinks.
Well, you said he drank on a boat.
He drank sherry on a boat.
Okay.
But I mean, that's what I would drink on a boat.
Yes.
But that's because I would drink sherry
anywhere.
At the theater, on a boat, in a plane. It's like my green eggs and ham.
Yeah.
Someday I just want to be an old feared persona in a village that is surrounded by casks of sherry and bats. That's the future I want for
That's
myself.
Very specific.
Yes.
I mean, you're in luck that the Halloween decorations are going out early this year. You're getting spooky already. Well, thank you so much for all of those questions. Those were lovely. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy that so many people sent them in that we have to actually do a two-part question and answer episode. So if you didn't hear your question answered on this one, then we're going to answer it next week.
Just looking, Stephanie, Jonathan, Michael, Lauren, Sarah, Nicole, Austin, Rouge Goat again, Lost in Boca. You're all of your questions are coming up next week. Oh,
you read it as Rouge Goat. I've been saying Rogue Goat.
Oh.
I don't know which one is correct.
Well, Rogue is R-O-G-U-E.
Oh, well, it's Rouge Goat, and I've been saying Rogue Goat.
Well... Anyway, we've got another round of like of 12 questions coming up next week. And then, of course, you join us on the live stream this Saturday. And we will... Oh, this is going to be fun. We got to figure out what cocktails to make. I'm going to just throw it out there. Maybe I'll make a... Have I made a bamboo on the live stream before?
No, I don't think you have.
I don't think I have, so...
This is going to be the last, not the last live stream, but it's going to be the last one that is going to be on our public YouTube. So we are going to be doing more live streams, a lot more live streams, but we're going to be offering them on our Patreon. And once again, if you want to see any of those, you can join our Patreon for $1. And that's it. Any level on our Patreon membership, you will be able to see the live streams that we're going to be doing. We're going to be doing some fun stuff, especially coming up for spooky season. But we will still be doing video companions to all of our episodes. They're just not going to necessarily be live stream all the time.
Right. So if you don't have money to join a Patreon right now or you're just not interested, don't worry. There'll still be video content available on our YouTube on a regular basis corresponding to each episode.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you to everyone who sent in a question. And also, if you join our Patreon, you are welcome to send us a question at any time. We will always catch up with that with our Q&A episodes that are going to be periodic, but this is our second installment of Q&A episodes, and turns out that we have to do a second episode to the second installment.
We should do these maybe like once a quarter, I think.
Yeah.
Because like, there were a lot of questions here.
Yeah, and psyched, great questions.
I feel like some of these questions, maybe that wedding already happened, and whoops, I hope not. I hope the wedding happened.
I hope that we didn't miss it, but I also hope that everything went off without a hitch. A couple of the weddings that I was scheduled to attend this year got a little postponed, so maybe we didn't miss you, but congratulations to the happy couple in whatever respect, and so sweet on you for thinking of them like that.
Absolutely. So we will see you next week for the rest of your questions.
Yeah, thank you to Absurdist for our theme music.
I've been Taylor Smurl.
And I've been Liz June.
And this has been Neat.